to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. You know, this Thursday marks the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. Among those who volunteered were a handful of women who were specially qualified to operate the most advanced communication technology of the day. You know what it was? It was the telephone switchboard. Our guest today is Elizabeth Cobb. She holds the Melbourne Glasscock Chair at Texas A&M University and a research fellowship at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Her books have won 4 literary prizes, 2 for American history and 2 for fiction. And today we'll be talking about her latest book. It's called The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. And maybe you had a relative or knew of a woman who served in World War I or maybe even World War II. Love to hear about those stories and love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Elizabeth Cobbs, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Larry. I'm so delighted to be with you this morning.
Oh, I tell you what, I loved your book. It was fascinating to me. And I wondered, as I was reading, I wonder how she got interested in the story of these first women soldiers. What got you interested?
Well, and that's a good question. I mean, and also, how can you even find them? Because
yes,
it's such a hidden story, sort of like Hidden Figures, actually, to which it's been compared.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to do something for World War One. I'm a historian. Yeah. I'm a working historian. And so I thought, gosh, this really big thing's coming up that I think we don't have much feeling for here in America. We don't quite get it. And so I thought, you know, either you could do another book on Woodrow Wilson or look for something that would really help us get how people felt about it, what it meant to them, and how America participated.
You know, it's interesting. Jill Nadeau, my producer, and I were talking before the show, just remembering that in school we got very little World War One history. It was mostly World War Two. We kind of gave World War One short shrift.
Well, and I think one reason for that is the U.S. was so late to the war.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw this funny film called Chicken Run, and the British character says, "Those Yanks, late to every war," which we tend to be, we used to be, let's put it that way. So I think, yeah, Americans don't have a sense for, you know, what its significance was. But certainly for people like the British, you know, they actually lost 3 times more soldiers in World War I than in World War II.
Yeah, France lost a lot more in World War I, didn't they?
Yeah, and of course, one of the differences there, France was occupied in World War II, so they didn't have the same kind of casualties. But yes, France, oh my gosh, was just bled white. I mean, parts of northern France were truly lunar landscapes for years, just chewed up.
You say that the First World War set the stage for the entire 20th century. What do you mean by
that? Well, World War One is sort of that moment. I mean, there's sort of bigger issues here, but, you know, where the whole world goes, my gosh, you know, we can't afford to let an industrialized war happen. I mean, even think of that today, Larry. You know, when we think of the technologies we have, and World War One was the first time that technology, of all kinds of forms of mass destruction, as well as mass communications, you know, facilitated the efficient killing of people in this really tragic way. So that was one of the things, you know, it led to the first international organizations. It also changed women's lives dramatically. I mean, before the war, for 70 years, women had made the outrageous, you know, scandalous demand for the vote.
Yeah.
And for 70 years, you know, they'd been beaten back both by men and women saying, oh, my goodness, please, you know, that would just be, that'd be terrible. Women would become men. And so one of the things the World War does, and my book shows that, it shows how women's women being soldiers made them seem much more eligible for the vote as well. And of course, even in our own earlier, much earlier in the American Revolution, why we stopped, you know, putting property qualifications on the vote was because, you know, average men would pick up their, you know, their muskets and go out to defend the Republic.
Yeah. You know, I was really glad that you started your book with women's suffrage and a little bit of the history of women's suffrage, because it reminded me again, I'm thinking they're shaking my head. And, you know, sort of course, I wasn't there at the time, but you went, what were people thinking? But I'm glad you set the stage that way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma for an author sometimes, because, of course, the individual stories of these women are so fun and sometimes, to me, so funny that you just want to rush right to that part of the story. And of course, the book, as you know, is mostly about their very interesting adventures. But as a historian, you know, I think that that context is so important, because it tells us, you know, why, you know, how these women plugged into these really big issues that they were aware of. I mean, you could read their stories and not really get that when Woodrow Wilson says to the U.S. Senate, you know, women have served on the very skirts of the battle, if you didn't know their story, you also wouldn't know why what he was saying to the Senate really hit home for those guys who had otherwise sat there through vote after vote turning down women's suffrage, but suddenly realized, you know, we can't do that anymore.
Yeah. And just remind us why it took the U.S. so long to enter World War I, and why it took more than a year after that to actually fight.
I know. Isn't that funny? So, yeah, the U.S. gets into the war about 3 years into it, almost 3 years, not quite. And before and when the war first broke out, Woodrow Wilson famously said, you know, this is something that cannot touch us. You know, that's far away, and it's America's tradition is one of neutrality, which it had been for 150 years. But what happens in the course of 3 years is that, you know, Wilson tries again and again to mediate an end to the conflict. He calls for what he called the peace without victory. You know, this is not about getting things. This is about, you know, leaving countries whole and restoring peace, which everybody else thought was kind of a lunatic idea. Wait a minute. Isn't the whole point of going to war so I can get your stuff? You know, this Woodrow Wilson's really trying to move us in this direction, which is so important. I mean, it's so important today. It's why we don't go in and rob countries, you know, if we've been in a war with them where we sort of win, so to speak. It's not about robbing or robbery. So the U.S. gets in late, and as finally we find the war does touch us. Germany resumes what's called unrestricted submarine warfare and starts blowing our ships out of the water, our merchant ships, you know, not naval vessels, but merchants. And so, having painted himself into this corner, Woodrow Wilson goes, okay, you know, we can't do that. And actually, there's a very strong support, although there's a debate, too, in the Congress about what it will mean for America to drop this 150-year tradition of neutrality in European wars that went back to George Washington.
Yeah. Well, talk about General John Pershing, Black Jack Pershing, and his role in bringing women into the Army.
Yeah, Black Jack Pershing is this interesting character that, you know, hope your listeners will go on and Google him if they can't picture him. He's this sort of, you know, classic ramrod straight, you know, central casting could not have found a better
handsome
man.
Handsome guy.
Handsome guy. And a lot of historians say, oh, well, this guy is, you know, the stiff, kind of dull general. But, you know, there in his nickname was Black Jack. There's a clue there. At the end of the 19th century, he served on the prairies. He was from Missouri, and he served with the Buffalo Soldiers, black African-American soldiers. And he said, you know, these are good soldiers. They need training like, you know, most men, all men do, but they were very valorous, and, you know, they were, you know, brave, competent soldiers. And when he got to West Point and was an instructor there, well, the white cadets thought, well, you know, who is this guy? And they called him Black Jack. Actually, they called him a worse word that I won't repeat on public radio, but the insult got commuted kind of as he went up. And finally, people didn't even remember why he was called Black Jack. But Black Jack Pershing had worked with African Americans and kind of knew that if you're in a pinch and somebody's trying to blow your head off, you just want the person with you. It doesn't matter their gender or their race. It just matters mostly whether they are competent. Now, by the way, there are a lot of racial issues in World War I won't go into, but this is the point that Pershing, when he got to France, he said he realized when he tried to put a call through that it wasn't going anywhere. And that was so important because this truly is the only technology in which the United States was in the lead. When we supplied things to World War I, we were supplying raw steel, men, mm-hmm. muscle, yeah. Blood, materials that they then could process into tanks and planes and guns and such things. For the most part, especially heavy artillery, the United States had no factories even for that kind of material. And so, but we were really good with the telephone, which of course had been invented here in the United States. And the United States had not only more telephones, but the best telephones. And they had this central, ingredient. Because this was a period, Larry, where we might be talking on phones now, but a phone had no dials. It was what they called a candlestick phone. It was this black thing that sort of shaped like a candlestick, and if you wanted to make a call, you lifted up the receiver and you spoke into this little funnel, and the operator would say number please, or hello, and that's why they were called the hello girls. But then these women, in these sort of dulcet, calm tones, were working like maniacs. They were the classic duck. It looks calm on the surface, but down below, they're madly peddling. So they would be simultaneously translating in French and English in a war zone while bombardment is going off around them. It's so loud, it's shaking their switchboards. One operator whose diary I found, she was sitting so near in the vicinity of General John Pershing that at one moment he kind of yelped in her ear, and she said, "Sir, what happened?" He said, "A shell just went right past my head." Now, he's sitting in a little railroad car that's about 50 yards from her. So this is the environment in which some operators work. Now, most were well behind the lines, but they're all of them dared crossing the Atlantic when there were submarines patrolling for them and aiming for them. Some of them actually served, as I said, under aerial and artillery fire when they were in Paris and near the front.
And working as a switchboard operator was a good job for women in the early 1900s, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, to give you a sense, their leader, the first leader of the Hello Girls, was a wonderful, spunky, funny young woman named Grace Banker. Now, Grace was a Columbia graduate. She had gone to Barnard College. Her degree said Columbia University, and her best job was as a telephone operator. So other than school teaching, telephone operating was about the highest paid occupation a woman could get. And that's one of the reasons why they realized they needed women, because this was a sex-segregated occupation. And also women had the nerves for it. Now, isn't that funny? We think of, women not having the nerve to go into battle, and that was the concern. Of course, it was one of the many, many reasons not to bring women into combat. But they actually said, the Army said, these women can take it. So they've got, five generals yelling at them in different languages, and they're making calls, and they're checking connections, and they're putting toll calls through multiple lines. Lines are getting blown up. They have to figure out what's the best routing. Oh, that line's down. Well, of course, we know why that line's down. And then they were doing it all in code because the Germans could, if they could get a German could find a line, they could tap the line. Now, by the way, radios at this time were completely unsecure, so you could pull a radio wave out of the air. But also radios didn't carry voices yet.
That's right.
So, it was Morse code. And so that made it harder to communicate, too. It delayed communications.
Elizabeth Cobb's our guest. We'll get to Scott in Winona, Minnesota, who has a comment for us. But just to remind you, her book is called The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. And you can join in with your questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll take a look at some of America's favorite sports myths with an author. So hope you can stay with us for that. And I hope you'll stay with us for our guest today, Elizabeth Cobb's author of The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. And again, you can join in 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Scott in Winona, Minnesota, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I'm enjoying your program a lot.
Thank you.
I work as a volunteer with the Winona Historical Society, and I just finished working on a display there of the commemorating the 100th anniversary on April 6th of the U.S. entry. And we found three Winonans that we profiled in this display, one of whom was one of the 10,000 Army Nursing Corps volunteers who went over. And she was assigned to a base hospital in France. And what a lot of people do not realize is that over 260 of these nurses died in service, most of the deaths being caused by Spanish influenza.
Yeah. Elizabeth, the Scott mentioned influenza, and actually I think disease killed a lot of people in World War One.
Oh my gosh, yeah, Scott's completely right. The Spanish influenza was the greatest hazard, and in fact, in some months, more soldiers died of influenza than even during the huge Meuse-Argonne offensive. More people were dying of Spanish influenza. So the nurses, of course, were so brave, and they were there, you know, pulling people through and, you know, and exposing themselves to these great hazards. One of the Hello Girls actually fell ill of Spanish influenza, and I was reading her medical records, and it's just amazing that, you know, first of all, the doctors can't do much for these folks, so it's really the nurses who just try everything to keep them alive, and then of course some of them perish as well.
And there wasn't the kind of medical advances that we have today to treat something like that.
Right, no antibiotics.
No antibiotics.
Right, so people wouldn't, they died usually of the pneumonia infection in their lungs that was accompanied the Spanish influenza. So we think today that some of them could have been saved because of these opportunistic infections. You're completely right. The Spanish influenza was very, very hazardous. And in fact, the two Hello Girls who died of Spanish influenza.
Yeah. Scott, thanks, and good for you for putting that display together. Appreciate it. Thanks very much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. Well, what qualifications? I was amazed at the qualifications the Army required of women hoping to become members of the Signal Corps.
Yeah, part of this was that one of the reasons why the Army was having such a tough time is because the technology in those days, if you wanted to, as they say, put a call through, you actually had to do a relay with operator after operator, depending on how far the line the call was going. So, I mean, I'm sure many of us have seen the old movies where they say, your call is available, sir, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, why does it take an operator to put a call through? But literally, they would have to create a relay. So they'd be talking with other American operators, but also other French operators. And then sometimes they'd be getting French officers on the line. So these Hello Girls had to go through an extraordinarily tough language, series of language tests. They also had to learn all different kinds of ways, all the various forms of operating, because some of them actually had not been operators ahead of time. They were just really crackerjack at bilingual translation. So for example, there were two young women who lied about their age to get in, and they were from, you won't be surprised at this, they were from Berkeley, California. So they were scamps, but they really wanted to serve, and they were Franco-American, so they and their parents had spoken French in the home. And you had to train on different kinds of boards, magnetic boards versus what they called common battery boards. Some of these were the old, literally crank 'em up phones, because that's how they would generate an electrical charge. So the women, had to survive all these elements of training, and also there were medical exams. Now, by the way, remember, this is a period when dresses are still, down covering up your ankles. And so these were women who had to go through Army exams, physical exams, because nobody wanted to send a woman off to France if she wasn't really well. And sometimes, by the way, there were injuries caused by that. For example, one woman got inoculated, and again, vaccines were really new, and the women had to be willing to just take these vaccines. The Army's so funny. The Army said that a lot of the men would faint when they got these vaccinations, but the women were such troopers. This particular group were, just quite amazing. But one of them got a vaccine, and then the orderly, put a swab on it that he thought it was rubbing alcohol, and actually it turned out that it was
acid. Yes.
Yeah, and so she had permanent arm and nerve damage. But here's the sad part, Larry. So the sad part is that the Army had a very different attitude towards women than did, oddly enough, the Marines or the Navy. So if you have Marine listeners out there, Navy folks, they'll be pleased to hear that their services really stood by the women and offered them things like war risk insurance. Although, frankly, if you, as the Army and Navy, and primarily the Navy and Marines kept everyone at home. So the war risk insurance really should apply to those women who were literally, whose lives, were at risk. But the Army never, in the behind the scenes, the bureaucrats never really gave the women the status that the Army did. And so when the women got home, some of them who had permanent disabilities had trouble even getting hospitalization. Some of them had permanent tuberculosis, for example.
Well, Inez Crittenden died in France, and she had paid for that insurance.
You read that book closely. Yeah, I want you in my class, Larry. Extra points. Yes, so here's a woman who led the second group of women over, and she paid for war risk insurance because soldiers were required to pay a little something for this risk insurance, but if they were killed, their families were taken care of. And so she paid for this, lost her life. And then the family was told, oops, actually, she really wasn't qualified for the insurance. So sorry. So that was less than honorable, of course.
Yeah, very much less than honorable. Well, talk a little bit more maybe about Inez and some of the other leaders, mostly the women who led this group.
Yeah, well, the one I focused on a lot most, whose story really dominates the book, is a woman named Grace Banker. And she, it's part of the fun of being a historian is to, follow these people and find them in a way. So I have a friend who is absolutely amazing. She works for a public history company called History Works in Chicago. And I called her and I said, can you help me figure out where I might find a descendant of this woman? Now, of course, women change their names and their daughters change their names at that time. So finding somebody can be tricky. Anyway, she gave me a call and said, hey, Elizabeth, I think I found in a nursing home in New Hampshire, a person who answers this description. And so I was really lucky that that turned out to be the case. And that was how I found that particular diary. And then another woman who I followed quite closely was named Merle Egan. Now, Merle Egan, a different sort of character from Grace. Merle was a Westerner. So Grace was from New Jersey, New York, and kind of a proper, East Coast kind of young lady. And Merle was, a Westerner raised in, Montana, working in Denver, then, had worked throughout the West and ultimately ended up in Washington. But she was the woman who ran the switchboard for the Versailles Peace Conference for the United States. So she's putting Woodrow Wilson literally together on the line with, the George Clemenceau, the Premier of France, or David Lloyd George of England. And when she got back, she was so upset that these women who had endured really permanent disabilities, that they would never get hospitalization, they would not, they would not get pensions, they would not get their victory medals, they would not get a flag on their coffins. That unlike the men they'd served alongside, and unlike women who'd served in the Navy and Marines. So she started a 60-year battle. And I found her and her memoirs and her papers, again, this kind of fun process of digging. I knew that in the 70s there was a young male attorney, a young man, who got so interested in these women's cause that he called up this 80-year-old who by then was in a nursing home, and he said, I heard about you. Hello, girls, and do you need an attorney? And so after she'd been working with Congress and politicians and newspapermen for 60 years, this young attorney took up her you know, her cause. And so I contacted the Seattle Bar Association, and I said, you know, about 40 years ago, there was a man who was an attorney. And so they gave me an email that sort of didn't work, and eventually I got a hold of him, and I found Merle's papers. But she was one of these wonderful women, and for whom, you know, the message of old age was not to slow down, but to hurry up. Yeah. And when she was in her late 80s, she was just working it. You know, by that time, by the way, she's petitioning Jimmy Carter, and she's working with, of all people, as an oddball combination, the National Organization for Women, and Barry Goldwater.
Yeah.
And Barry Goldwater was hot under the collar because he had been a pilot in World War II, and he knew that women in World War II, like a number of women in World War I, had not gotten their due from the U.S. government. Now, he, you know, as a pilot, he was interested in what were called the WASPs, the Women's Air Service Program. I'm sorry, I've got the acronym wrong there, but it's, they were called WASPs. So Barry Goldwater, you know, led the campaign to help out those women and also the women of World War I, you know, really be recognized. And like the nurses that Scott was referring to, the World War II pilots had real risks. I mean, they were, they went into the ditch. They had a better flying record, incidentally, than the men, as Barry Goldwater pointed out. But one of their jobs, for example, was to tow targets so that junior pilots could learn to fire correctly. So I don't know about you, but to volunteer for that job took some real, it took real courage.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you just wonder about the motivation. Was it patriotism that motivated these women to become soldiers, essentially?
You know, I think, Larry, this is where historical imagination comes in the sense that we have to, and that's why building a context is important. When people do something really different, then we go, huh, why would they do that? We have to understand all the things that go around their lives. And part of this was the feeling that Americans had towards their country at the time, you know, that kind of a patriotism, which I think actually many of us felt on the morning of September 11th.
Yeah.
But, you know, that kind of feeling where, tell me what I can do, and I will do anything I can. And so these women had that sense of patriotism. Funny, one of them, I love this woman. And, you know, I'm trying to think, was she from Wisconsin? She might have been. She was from one of those northern Midwestern states. And she was going out with a young man at the time. And she had several older brothers. She was French Catholic, you know, and so she had a big family. And a couple of her brothers, one had volunteered for the Marines and one for, you know, the Army or something. But the young man she was going out with was like, well, you know, I'm sure they're going to draft, and I'll wait for the draft. So that was the end of that date.
That took care of that.
Yeah, and she also felt like her brothers were risking a lot, and it wasn't right for her to just sit home and knit, although knitting was something women were encouraged to do for the war effort, but she, you know, she wanted to do more.
And I do, I can't recall her name right off the top of my head, but there, you talk about one woman who was married, and she volunteered for the Hello Girls, and her husband was in the service, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, theirs was an interesting story because, again, a lot of these women kind of skirted some regulations, as some men did, too, to, you know, young men who wanted to get in. Now, in her case, you weren't supposed to be in the Army if your husband was in the service as well. They didn't want, you know, they didn't want a situation where, you know, I guess both members of would die, or I don't quite even know what the thinking was, but you weren't supposed to. But somehow she wiggled in. Her name was Bertha Hunt.
Ah, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, and again, she was one of the people who, up this process, I found, after I located Merle Egan's papers, I found a typescript of a diary, and at the top of it was an old phone number. And I thought, what are the chances of this phone number from, again, 40, 50 years ago, still working? But, you know, I'm going to try it. Some people hang on to their phone numbers. And I called it, and it turned out it was the nephew of this woman, Bertha Hunt. He said, oh, yeah, my aunt knew Bertha. So his aunt was actually a different woman, a woman named Louise Le Breton, the one who had lied about her age along with her younger sister. So these women kept in touch and had each other's papers. And so Bertha, she was very interesting. Her husband was an extremely dangerous duty off the coast of France as a naval officer. He was actually a physician, but he served on board of one of these little rickety ships. Again, no, the U.S. wasn't ready for this. Didn't have this kind of, equipment. So they got personal yachts. People donated their yachts and small boats, and they outfitted them. And he was on this duty off the coast of France, which, of course, meant, submarines are aiming for you all the time and sinking you. And by the way, I mean, he didn't get sunk, obviously, but there were a number of Americans who went down and American ships that went down.
And this was a really dangerous job for the women, too. I mean, it wasn't just behind the lines kind of thing all the time.
Well, for most, it was behind the lines. And that's true of most of the men, too, by the way, who served in World War One. There were about 4 million men who served during the conflict, and 1.5 of those were actually on the firing line, which just goes to tell you that any modern war effort requires a lot of people back home, in supply services in France, et cetera. So a lot of the women, it was dangerous because they crossed the ocean. Yes, they could have, been shot out of the water. Some of them then, when they got to France, in fact, some of them were disappointed. They wanted to be closer to the action. And actually, one of my favorite stories, because the Army was very loath to, expose women at all or bring them in. And there was a group of young women who were serving alongside General Jack Pershing. And after one of the big battles, which was the first time they just put women right there, next to the men taking these calls. Because, by the way, telephone lines ran into the trenches.
Yeah.
We think of, like the
just
best picture
amazing.
In the book. I know. I love this picture I got for the book from AT&T, because AT&T was, they were the ones who were making this all happen. And so they had telephone linemen, and there's all these telephone lines running right into the trenches. And so for that group of women who had served in this first really big battle that the U.S. was in, Pershing went up to them afterwards and he said, "Well, ladies, how are you doing?" And they said, "Very well, sir, thank you." And he said, "Is there anything else I can do for you?" And he said, "Anything else you would like?" And they said, "Yes, sir, we would like to be as close to the front as we can get." And he looked at them and turned to his adjutant and said, "Take them where they want to go."
Yeah. And I'm telling you, reading that the later chapter there, where they're right there during the most miserable fighting, terrific fighting of the war. They had to be right there. Some of them working 22 hours straight or something like that without sleep.
That's right. That's right. And that was especially true of what were called the chief operators, people like Grace Banker and Inez Crittenden, whom you mentioned, who died. These, they had to be sure. And during these great offensives, the preparation for the offensives was immense. They were, coordinating and getting calls through and, getting people up to the front line and even firing. So Bertha Hunt, whom we just spoke about, they all had watches. And I don't know if you remember, I'm old enough to remember when you could call an operator or, dial and find out what is the time. So these men would call these operators and say, "Operator, what's the time?" And she'd be looking at her watch and saying, "Okay, now, 3 a.m., and they'd fire.
It's amazing. Lance in Brown Deer, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, today is the 73rd birthday of my cousin, whose mother was my mother's younger sister, who was a nurse in World War II until she got pregnant. But her husband was a doctor, and he fought from Australia all the way to Japan. Mm. And she came and lived with us because, you couldn't be pregnant and be an Army nurse. But she's been a magnificent woman, as they say, 103, and still pretty much with it. And that's one of my main memories of World War II, because I was only, I was born in 37, so I was only that kid.
Pretty young then.
Yep.
Well, it's a great story. Thanks, Lance, for sharing that. And it's, you know, it's too bad you were, obviously, you were never able to talk to those women, Elizabeth, who actually experienced it. But you were, through their diaries, able to get a lot of great information about their thoughts and feelings.
Yes, I mean, that's the immediacy is wonderful. Like, you know, you're reading it, and as I said, you know, they hear things go off, or they're going out, and they're seeing the flashes of the artillery, or Grace Banker, you know, runs back in and says, oh, my gosh, you know, I just about get a piece of shrapnel on my head, and my superior's mad at me because I went out without my trench helmet. But, you know, I think that Lance brings up a really interesting point. There's this sort of, to reach out and touch, to know, have known those people, whether we knew them because they were in our families or whether we meet them in the pages of history, they're sources of inspiration. I mean, they tell us that we've all gone through rough times before and people rise to the occasion. And so, I mean, I always find that history provides a lot of, you know, a lot of guidance for us in dealing with the, you know, the crises we face even today. So, you know, bravo that family took him in, and I wish I could shake her hand at 103. But, you know, one person I did meet, and this was great fun, I got a hold of Grace Banker's granddaughter. Now, a lot of these family members really didn't know what their grandmothers or great aunts had been like, you know. So, you know, and you're letting them know, oh, my gosh, she was such a scamp. You know, if somebody boring came in the front door and she heard their voice, she'd go out the window in the back. Oh, my gosh, I can't stand to talk to that YMCA woman again. Speaking of things like court martial, you know, being called on the carpet, there was this one young woman who, yeah, was, I don't know, she was too lively or something, and so she was threatened with court-martial. And there was another woman who actually was court-martialed, and I hate to tell you this, I started to laugh when Lance was telling us this story, because this woman got pregnant and she wasn't married. So there was one woman who was sent home. And actually, the records are not completely full about that. The reasons in the Army records are a little mysterious and opaque. But the women later said, oh, yeah, you know, we knew about her. This is why she, you know, went home right at the time of the armistice.
There was a little romance involved in all of it, too. I know you tell one story about an officer who kept going back to meet, asked for candy to be delivered to his place, and wound up marrying that gal eventually.
Yeah, that's right. So, and that's the interesting thing too. How do women in wartime? How do you not let? And of course, the Army today, and you know, has to think about these things, our armed services, Marines, etc. How do you put women next to men without it devolving into simply, you know, romantic or sexual kinds of things? And so this was the first time that we had to deal with that. And it's just kind of fun to look back. How do people handle that? How do they carry themselves? Some of them did end up marrying, you know, but a lot of them, like Grace Banker, I think she was frankly in love with an Australian officer and he with her, but, you know, she had to be, you know, she had to be the chief operator. And so, and especially in the Victorian era, they're just coming out of the Victorian era. So this is also, you know, kind of a delicate dance in several respects.
Well, I have to tell you, I really enjoyed your book, Elizabeth. It was so much fun to read and so enlightening. And I thanks so much for writing it. I hope we have a chance to talk again. This is wonderful. And obviously, we didn't get through half of what you have in the book, not even a percentage. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Scott, for the opportunity.
I appreciate it very much. Elizabeth Cobbs is the author of The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers. It is such a fun read, and what great timing for this book right now, when we've got, in just a couple of days, it'll be the 100th anniversary of our entry into World War I. And the stories of these women is really fascinating. So I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. Well, we're going to switch gears. We're going to still talk to an author, but we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about things like why Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak is considered a great record in sports history and why it may not be all that great. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network.